Welcome to the Genus Brewing live stream, the live stream that we do every Sunday morning at 8:45 Pacific Standard Time, where we go over, well, lots of fun things. Usually we start out with some beer news and some Genus news, give some updates around the shop, as well as what's going on in the beer industry around, well, for the most part, the United States. Maybe the world might make it in there a few times. Really? Really? And then we go on to a beer of the week, where we do a breakdown of a random beer judging certification program style. And then we go on to some discussion topics from there, which we open up to general questioning at the end. So
let's just dive into some beer news. The Brewers Association.
He's really hot, by the way.
Logan now has mouth cancer. Brewers Association is taking a hit because they are nonprofit.
That was the thing that I saw. So they are going through their second round of layoffs, apparently. So Brewers Association, if you guys bought a membership through them, I'm sorry. Sounds like you're not really getting much out of it, because they had to cancel a whole bunch of their events that raise a lot of funds for them. And unfortunately, they are not eligible for any of the bailouts because they're a 501c6 or something like that.
C3.
I think they're a C6, actually.
Why would they be C6?
I don't know. It's a slightly different classification. Don't worry about that. That's not the big deal. The big deal is that they're eating their shorts for breakfast. So that sucks. So if you can, maybe give them a little bit of little support. So otherwise, that's really the only thing I found for general beer news around the nation this week. So let's go on to what happened. Really?
I was trying to move my mic and my coffee was there.
Yeah. What happened at Genus this week? And to start with, we got a little crazy on a big stout, a nice 8-9% stout, and threw some maple syrup in it because YOLO.
Yeah, the rest of it definitely tastes a little bit on the aggro side, and so we know that that's going to taste phenomenal once it's aged out a lot. But we wanted to get some of it on tap soon because we're out of dark beers, and so we went ahead and back-sweetened with some really, really delicious maple syrup from a company called Spice Jungle. And now it's tasting phenomenal, and that's on tap.
There you go. So new beer on tap. We got some sweet vanilla. You see what I did there? Sweet vanilla. Because vanilla is actually not that sweet. I don't know why I say that. Everything you put it in is sweet, though. So
right. It's related to sweet things. Let me get a towel here. Super sweet vanilla came in, though, and I'm stoked for it.
Yeah, we got those from Beanilla, right?
Beanilla, which is owned by Spice Jungle. Yep. Company as the maple syrup.
All right, there you go. Same company as the maple syrup, Beanilla, which is owned by Spice Jungle. So we got in a whole bunch of different vanilla extracts of varying degrees.
Tahitian vanilla.
And
Mexican
they are
vanilla.
Very, very high
Madagascar
quality.
Madagascar vanilla.
You done?
Double fold Madagascar vanilla.
Very high quality.
Vanilla maple syrup.
We already made one cream soda with them. Have we dosed any beer with them yet?
We haven't dosed any beer with them, though, but one of those, the double fold Madagascar bourbon vanilla, is going straight into our yearly Count Chocula, which is going to be upwards of 10.5% to 11% this year.
Very nice. Yes. Yeah. In that, you know, not quite seven barrel batch anymore because it went all over the floor. Don't want to talk about that right now, though. But yeah, vanilla. It's got some really good quality vanilla, and we are excited to use it. The cream soda is tasting fantastic with it in there.
Yeah, anything that we've done with it so far in all of our tests. What we do is we do small batch tests with different like beers on tap, and like obviously with just water to get our cream soda dosages, and they all tasted really, really good.
Peter's sounding a little quiet, so maybe just get a little closer to Mike, by the way.
That's when I spilled my coffee.
Oh, yeah.
I was getting close to my mic.
And and then we also got the last bit of footage for Will It Beer Challenge number 6 done. So hopefully we'll be getting that out to you. We got some final edits to do on it still, but
talk about that for at least 2 minutes
this next week. How can I talk about that for 2 minutes? What are you doing? Oh, he's turning off excessive noise. So we got that done, and then lastly, was that yesterday, Peter? What day is it?
was that
yesterday or Friday that we did the two beers back to back?
Oh, that was yesterday. But is like super fast yesterday morning? No, it's Friday because Ryan was in.
Okay, so that was on Friday, I guess. You know, days, nights, whatever time is, all goes by the same time, and. We did 2 5-gallon batches of beer in just over. We were hoping to be under 2 hours, but we ended up doing 2 all-grain batches, like start to finish. minus cheating a little bit with some strike water. But
we were handicaps too because people wanted to buy stuff from us during that time.
Yeah, we managed to get those done in basically 2 hours, and we did actually get some footage of that. So
yeah,
we got
the beers done while filming while running the shop with just the two of us.
Yeah, so that was kind of fun actually. I'm really excited to see how they both turn out. You know, we got sugar in them, so that was probably the biggest challenge of making all that happen. And they're fermenting away as we speak. So
yeah, and both of our OGs turned out pretty good for the Grainville side. Yeah. I mean, I think our efficiency wasn't terrible. You got like a 1040 OG and I got a 1060
Yeah,
OG.
Mine was definitely low, but you know, the 6 gallons of batch size and then putting two of that on the floor didn't probably help anything.
You know, that's just where it belongs, is on the floor.
Floor needed to be cleaned anyway. Yeah, so that's all for beer news for Genus this week.
Yeah. So that, I guess, brings us to our
Beer of the Week.
Boop, boop, boop. Beer of the Week. Boom. Which is International Dark Lager Style 2C, a style that was not on the pre-2015 guidelines and that we are relatively unfamiliar with, except for, you know, having tasted a good chunk of the commercial examples that are listed on the BJCP app.
And by a good chunk, I've tasted exactly one that was listed.
I've tasted three of them.
Where's my bomb?
The first, speaking of which...
So
an international dark lager, the best way to describe this, abbreviating the BJCP guidelines, is that this is a spinoff of a international pale lager, which is going to be a very, very, you know, simple, pale, clean, easy drinking beer.
European Budweiser.
European Budweiser. But a little bit higher ABV than something like an American lager. And it's going to have a higher color and a slightly kind of thicker body to it.
Yeah, it's basically, so it's got all the same properties, you know, out of a light sessionable beer, but with that reminiscent of that darker caramel tone. I think it can be anywhere between like 12 and 18 SRM. So from that orangey amber to like a relatively pretty solidly dark amber. Makes me think of Bud Black Crown, although that wasn't one of the style beers listed, and that's also out of commission these days. I think it was only around for like 2 years.
Yeah, but probably didn't make money from it.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a weird way for them to try to jump into. Then they just started buying craft breweries, so they didn't have to like pretend that they made craft beer. But yeah, Shiner Bock is also probably the most common in America that a lot of people have tasted.
Yeah, and that is the one that I have had.
And for those of you in the outside of America world, other commercial examples include Baltica, number 4, Devil's Backbone, Old Virginia, St. Polliner Girl Dark, might have had that, and Session Black Dark Lager, you've probably had that.
Oh, yeah, yes, I have had that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I always thought that was a Schwarz beer, but apparently not. Probably not thick enough for a Schwarz beer is why.
Yeah, you can kind of think of it like Schwarzy themed, but with, you know, more commercial and large
a more
scale.
Adjuncty Schwarz.
Sure.
Because, yes, typically these will have some degree of adjuncts, either usually
simple sugar,
yeah,
corn.
And or corn, yeah.
Yeah. And then they are also noted by having some sort of a caramel color and then a very small to almost no caramel flavor.
Funny you mention that because our malt of the week, we decided to settle on actually a caramel or crystal 75 malt.
Yeah, the reason being we wanted to aim for something that we can add into this beer that will darken it and we don't have to add a ton. Because like we said, we don't want to get into that thick caramel flavor. So we're thinking anywhere from like maybe a quarter to a half a pound would be all the more you wanted to go with this.
And that is going to give you that nice color range, which hopefully will answer somebody's question at the same time on here. These are generally going to be a sort of medium amber color to a medium brown color in their hue. So usually not fully black, but can be fairly dark to a moderate amber.
We also talked about maybe doing some sort of an adjunct with this because simple sugars are definitely one thing that you want to get in this style. They finish at a very low final gravity. Oftentimes when you're using simple sugars, we think of dextrose, but to get that extra kind of toffee-y tone and then additional darkness, we thought of doing dark brown sugar as one of the adjuncts.
Yep, I would probably use actually quite a bit too of this because the overall grain bill of this beer is probably going to be fairly simple and fairly low. For something like a 5-gallon batch, you're probably only looking at 9-ish pounds maybe. I probably wouldn't go anywhere over 10, even though this can be up to a 6% beer. And that's because you will be supplementing with, you know, using something like brown sugar, a half a pound, maybe even up to a pound. If you want to get real crazy with it, it just kind of depends on what you're shooting for that with that sort of color spectrum.
Yeah, overall, you're probably going a really low overall bill. I would say in the actual malts that you're using, not including the sugars, you might even only be going like 6 to 7 pounds. And then you get that extra pound to pound and a half from the combination of dextrose and brown sugar, or if you're going a lower amount, just all brown sugar.
Yep. And then if you do want to darken it up to the kind of the extreme brown end of that, what we would recommend would be any kind of debittered malt, but really, really small amounts.
Or just artificial coloring.
I guess you could do artificial coloring. Yeah.
Like the big boys do.
Because one of the things in the style is that you are not, unlike a Schwarz beer, you're not trying to get any degree of really roasty character in there. So if you are going to use some kind of a dark malt to try to bump that color up, I would go with, you know, some kind of Carafa or something debitter, and literally like an ounce is all. I would not go over that. And I think, honestly, if you do have something that's in that like 300L range, then an ounce will actually give you all the color that you're looking for. So,
yeah. One of the things that it does outline on the BJCP guidelines for this is that it has zero roast quality, and even then, only a small amount of that caramel quality. That's why we're trying to keep those malts to a bone minimum while still getting that color and the essence that caramel is there without actually being very caramely.
Yep. All right. Well, so that breaks down the kind of grain bill for you. And then the hops, I kind of just thought of something that I haven't used in a while but would be perfect for this style. Typically, the hop presence in this beer is going to be low to moderate. Generally, traditional kind of spicy herbalness, but can have a little bit of floral character, but again, playing a very, very background note. So for the hop of the week, I chose U.S. Golding.
U.S. Golding is going to be a little bit less earthy and doesn't have the same kind of lemony tone that the Kent Golding is going to have. Overall, it has that dry kind of herbal note to it, that spicy earthiness, but on a very more much more subdued kind of quality. It's not as big and pungent as like that kind of noble Goldings. I use noble in quotes because it's not actually a noble hop. That noble kind of essence that Kent Golding has.
Yep. Your hopping rates are going to end up being very, very low on this style of beer. I would only shoot for probably the range of maybe an ounce. That's probably all you need, honestly. You're probably going to be putting in maybe less than a half ounce probably for bittering. What is the IBU on this? I didn't even look that one up.
I think it's like 8 to 15 or something.
Yeah, that's
like that.
So IBUs, very, very low. Probably a quarter to
8 to 20.
Yeah, so quarter ounce at for bittering addition if you're doing all grain, maybe half ounce if you're doing extract, and then maybe another half ounce at like a 10-ish minute addition. You're not really looking for, again, a lot of like big aromatics like you would an IPA, but to get a little bit of flavor, a little bit of kind of that herbal quality on the end, some kind of a late addition wouldn't be a terrible idea.
And someone's asking if a decoction mash darkens beer. Owen, hi from Kansas. Hi back. And,
oh, heck yeah.
Yes, it does. I guess the shorter answer would be it kind of depends. I know Brewlosophy actually did an experiment where they did a decoction mash and got zero difference in color. That didn't do it the same way that I would have done it. I'm not going to say that.
Oh, yeah. When I've done it, I've gotten a huge difference in color.
It really kind of depends on how you decoct. If you decoct too thinly, then it's not going to do a ton. But if you decoct in a really thick way, then yeah, it sure can.
Yeah, doing decoctions and increasing
boil
times definitely can increase color. But that also depends on if you're, like, boiling the decoction, which is what I did. I actually brought it up to, like, it was, like, bubbling in there.
You get to the point where you're caramelizing. It's just like caramelizing sugars.
That's all you're doing with it, so.
Yeah, you want to there's some people that have done, like, decoctions, too, that I know locally, and it's totally a fine way to do it where you're really just bringing your mash up to like kind of a boil, like almost a boil, and then adding that back in. That doesn't give it enough time on that heat to really, first of all, break down those sugars, because what it'll do is it'll explode sugars, and then doesn't give the time to caramelize those shorter chain sugars anyways.
Hello, Joshua. So anyway, decoction on this style, though, I don't think it's necessary. I think you actually, if it does affect the flavor, it's probably going to make for a richer, more complex flavor, which is not actually what you're going for in this beer. You're actually trying to keep it light. Final gravities are really low on this beer.
Yeah.
Usually single-digit final gravities. So I don't know that a decoction would actually get the effect that you're going for.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where you really don't want that extra maturity or that layer of flavor. You got to be really thinking like pollen, but with color.
Yep. So Wouldn't necessarily recommend it for this beer style. But speaking of clean and simple and high attenuating, let's go to our yeast of the week, which is the Fermentis S23, which is the Swiss lager yeast.
It has German origin, but that's the same lager yeast, I believe, that went down to a lot of different to the new breweries that were opening up in like Mexico at the time of, you know, the Märzen being, yeah, you know, kind of turned into what is now the Mexican dark lager style, the Dos Equis Negro Modelo style.
Yep, so that sort of cerveza Mexican lager strain then, which is just, it's going to be one of those strains that I think it ferments very, very clean, sort of through a wide temperature range as well. So it's going to be clean. It's not going to produce, you know, any kind of excessive degree of fruitiness, which is not what you're going for with this beer, and it'll attenuate high, which is sort of why we threw that guy on there, just because it's going to be an all-around good workhorse to finish out a beer like this.
Yeah.
Finally, something that, you know, we kind of added to our list of the beer of the week, which I feel like we've been starting to hit on with a lot of styles, but haven't actually listed it out, is actually the water chemistry for this style.
Yeah. And like you'd expect from a lot of clean American lager-esque style beers, we are keeping this profile very light, but to accentuate the fact that this is a malt pushing leaning. What's the best word for that? You let me know. Beer. We wanted to go high chlorides and maybe even a little bit of sodium in this. So I'm thinking in the range of, you know, maybe 20 parts per million of chlorides and sodium, where everything else is in that kind of 10 to 15 or even under range.
Yep. So overall, a very, very soft profile. If you want to try this at home, I'd honestly recommend starting from scratch with distilled water on this, just because you're really, really trying to, you know, push down the overall hardness of the water. And then again, upping those chlorides a little bit, but overall having a very, very low hardness level, you know, just enough calcium to get your conversion, and then really not much else in there. So
yes. Someone says malt forward. Yes, malt forward.
Malt forward. Yeah, no, it's definitely a malty style.
Like, slightly malty. Maybe, yeah, that's what we were going for.
Slightly malty, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like it's the German kind of malty where, yeah, you've like got a lot of malt flavor, but it's still a dry beer, which is people
there's
sort
one
of
into me trying to find the word that I was trying to look for. Malt leaning, malt. Like you whispered malt in its ear. That's probably the way to
go. Gently caressed by malt.
You just kind of toss malt nearby it. Malt greeting. I don't know. Anyways, malt, we should probably move on before this goes a little bit in the weird direction.
All right, let's get into our first discussion topic, which is going to be hot fermentations. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, we are moving into summer. You like how I like, say that as if people are watching us down in like New Zealand or something?
Yeah, I know. Weird. No one's ever done that.
But yeah, we are going into summer, and although today's pretty cool, it is going to get very warm very fast, which means that temperature control becomes a serious issue for home brewers.
Yeah, we've actually had a lot of days already that are in that 90 plus degrees. So yeah, if you're struggling to keep your AC down in that 66 to 68 degrees where some people like their air conditioning to be, normal people.
Note jacket.
then you're going to want to take a look at this option to ferment things hot and different strategies to do so, what your yeasts will do, and how to high five bears.
How to high five bears. Picking some, you know, fun styles that really, really like warm. So should we what should we go into? Should we just go straight into the elephant in the room, which is cook?
Yuck. So yeah, if you you know, just want to YOLO it, you have some 100 plus degree days and you just want to ferment that thing in your garage, go ahead and throw some quike at it and call it a day.
Yeah, that's one thing with this yeast strain that has really kind of been sweeping across the world, I think, is people are realizing that, wait, what? You can actually ferment a beer at 100 degrees and it still turns out fairly clean.
Yeah, and that's, tastes great.
That's kind of crazy to think about. But yeah, so quike strain for anything hop forward, I would recommend this for. You know, other non-IPA styles, I think it's kind of might be a little weird.
Yeah, I mean, if you ended up going into mixed firms, like anything that you were going to throw in a bottle with some, you know, Brett or something like that, and then let age out, you can definitely get into a bottle easier with quike. But there's really not, you're kind of pigeonholed with those subtly fruity styles, or at least styles that can mask some fruitiness. Tropical stout probably would also work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Tropical stout would be fantastic for it. So, yes, quike yeast, you know, when in heat, quike.
Beat your meat.
Quike it. I don't know where I was going there.
Yeah, I don't know. In heat, like a dog in heat.
Other styles, though, that are really going to benefit from a lot of heat on the yeast you're throwing at it are going to be a lot of your Belgian style beers too.
Saisons.
Yeah, saison. Those are going to ferment definitely on the hot side, especially with the Belgian, specifically the Belgian saison yeast, the Y yeast. What is it?
3724.
Yep.
Both of them can do well at high temperatures, but yeah, that Belgian one will rip. And I know a lot of people that like to reuse that too. So once it becomes just a beastly strain, because it does well with an overpitch too. Once you got like your third or fourth generation on that guy, it can rip. I know breweries who've gotten it up above 100 degrees and still made some really, really fantastic saisons.
I actually purposely try to ferment that one hot just because otherwise at low temps it almost always will stall on me. So that one, I mean, 80-90, go for it. Throw it up in your attic and just let it rip. Maybe not in your attic. Your attics can get like 120. That might actually kill it.
Maybe in my attic, not your attic.
A reasonable attic. that strain, French Saison, Bella Saison strain.
Any mixed firm Brett beer, especially with Brett Brux, will do well on the aging process if you're aging it super warm. I've done 100% Brett beer where I let it age at about 95 degrees, maybe 90 for about 4 months. And then it was actually had really phenomenal Brett character in a shorter amount of time than you'd normally expect.
Yeah. Even Belgian wit beers I've had ferment pretty darn clean at high temps as well.
Yeah.
So that's another option for you. You know, kind of the whole gamut of Belgians. With that said, other strains, you know, strains like Ardennes, Belgian strong ales, you're going to get different profiles depending on what temperature range you're fermenting them at.
Yeah, some of those flavored ones can get a little bit fusely or a little bit boozy, especially like the high alcohol style strains.
So, but you can also mitigate that by pitching a little heavier cell count at it too. So
pitching more yeast, adding nutrient, pressure fermenting, things like that.
Which kind of brings me to another thing about hot fermentations, which is the awesome part of them, is that they tend to finish a lot faster.
Yeah. We're just going to skip over the British and American with those.
I didn't say that. That's my segue into our next topic.
Topic number two. Remember that segue? It was a good transition. We're just gonna have to.
We're gonna redo that in a second.
So don't be upset when you receive. I do wanted to hit really quickly on what happens when you ferment things like British yeasts at warm temperatures, American yeast at warm temperatures, and even lager yeast at warm temperatures. Is it gonna ruin your beer? I guess is the first question.
Can somebody say rotten plum?
So British yeasts at that warmer temperature create some really pungent, strong, fruity notes. And I mean, it depends on the strain, of course, but I am not a huge fan.
They are. Yeah. That's my whole take on them too. If you've got temperatures over 70 degrees, British yeasts are pretty much out. When I'm brewing with them, I've even had them hit like just like 72, 73 degrees. Like that's like actual fermentation temp too, not even ambient temp, for, you know, a couple days during high krausen. And, you know, while that didn't absolutely ruin the beer, I definitely noticed an excessive degree of esters being thrown off by the yeast to the point where it was distracting in the beer.
It's one of those things that just sits heavy on your palate. And when you drink it, like, you might be able to be like, there's some good flavors in there for the first couple sips. But by the bottom of a pint, it just doesn't feel appealing. It doesn't feel like what you want to put in.
Yeah, it's probably actually something, I mean, if you've gone to, like, small breweries in the summertime, little nano guys that don't have temp control, I'll bet you've even tasted it in some commercial beer. And it's one of those things that you're just kind of like, it's like Peter said, you get to the end of the pint and you're like, I don't really know what that is, but I don't know if I want another pint of this now.
Yeah.
that's probably something to avoid in the summertime if you don't have temp control. So American yeasts, they tend to be a little bit more forgiving.
Yeah.
I know the Chico strain ferments pretty clean up to the mid-70s, but...
But still it ends up with like an off-bright zestiness a lot of the times with American strains.
Yeah.
So it can be distracting. It's just not going to be as off-putting. I've also noticed with those American strains, you can get that fusely, almost like diesel quality from warm fermentations.
Yeah.
It tastes like when you buy cheap alcohol.
When you buy the booze. There's no such thing as cheap alcohol. Lastly, let's talk about some lager strains though. Because lager strains are actually very interesting in the fact that it's very counterintuitive to ferment them hot. But I have actually fermented, especially the Weinsteffen lager strain is, I think, the classic example.
3470.
The 3470. I've actually fermented that at about 80 degrees before, and it produces just a really fantastic light fruity profile to any beer that you're trying to brew, which makes it really, really versatile for pretty much any. I mean, I don't know if I'd try to like throw it in like an amber ale or something like that, but any sort of lightish color beer, especially your hop forward beers, they end up turning out even, honestly, probably still at 80 degrees cleaner than like something like the
British
Chico
ale.
Strain.
Yeah, or Chico, yeah.
At 70 would. So yeah, that's actually a really fantastic thing. And that strain absolutely destroys beer when it is hot too.
Yep.
Yeah, we're talking like 2 to 3 day fermentations, almost to the level of the click.
And that also counts as a smooth and fluid transition into topic number 2.
Whoa, speaking of fast fermentations. Hey, you see what I did there? I got it, nailed it. yeah, so let's go ahead and go on to hot fermentations. And then,
from hot fermentations into our second topic, which is
speeding up fermentations and trying to brew quick turnaround beers.
Yeah, we're calling this one grain to glass in 6 days or less, although I think our best grain to glass that we've had here was 3 days.
3 days. Which one was that? Oh, that was the one we did for Craft Beer Week?
It was a local beer.
Local beer. Oh, we did that?
The Craft Beer Week one was 6 days.
Oh, was that 6 days? Yeah. I did one that one super fast, too, and it was actually with the 3470 strain.
Yeah. By the way, I see a lot of great questions rolling in. We'll get to those in a moment when we get to our Q&A, but let's roll through topic number 2 first and talk about how you get a good beer in its glass, crashed, ready to go in under 6 days. And first of all, this can be like how you tackle this task, what your strategy is, can be very dependent on things like what the OG of your beer is.
So obviously, even though Peter pitched Quike in his beer when we did the 2-hour beers the other day, mm-hmm. His was 1062, mine was 1040. I'm pretty sure that mine is going to be done before his. And that's just because there's, two-thirds of the sugars to chew through. Yeah, something like that. There's less sugars.
That does math correctly.
So there is less sugars to chew through. So if you are trying to turn over a beer quickly, brewing a session beer is actually a really good idea. You know, not trying to do an 8% imperial whatever. Stick to something that's, 4 or 5% range. That's just going to mean that your yeast chew through it a lot faster. You're going to have a lot easier time cleaning that beer up before you try to put it in a keg as well.
Yeah, and part of that also has to do with different lengths of sugar chains that are in there, or different types of sugars that are in there, which we'll get to in just a minute. But let's talk about different yeasts and your strategy for picking yeasts to make a beer go really fast. First of all, there's a couple yeasts that will absolutely beast mode this, and part of this has to do with our first topic, which is the temperature you ferment them at.
Yep, so like we already mentioned, actually, both of these strains, Quike and Saison strains, but also, like I said, the Weinsteffen lager strain also will just destroy beers. The other one that comes to mind is the classic German ale strain as well.
Yeah.
That guy.
That one rips.
Yep, that one definitely.
Don't expect it to be clean, though.
Definitely blow off on that one. Yeah, that one hardly ever drops bright for us without some extra goodies on it.
Yeah.
But, all those strains, fantastic for doing really, really quick turnover beers. Almost without fail, will ferment out a beer in 4 to 5 days.
Yeah, but the kings of this are definitely going to be your Quike and your Saison strains, just because there's more energy in the system because you can ferment those hot. And hot fermentation is one of the keys to making sure that these beers turn around. You want to make sure that's a very high-energy system, and those yeasts are, like I said, going beast mode on your sugar sources. But there are some other yeasts that can get a beer done in a quick amount of time. Your Chico strains, your classic SO4s. Most strains can get things done in a short amount of time, but that would have to mean that all the other circumstances are met, all the other conditions, like starting with a lower OG, which, like I said before, we'll talk about, also has to do with sugar source and what different kinds of sugars are in your beer.
Doing a nice low mash temp, I mean, that's going to help too. That's going to make sure that you get a nice dry beer. You got lots of fermentables in there.
And it's a single type of fermentable that's in there, which is maltose, when you have a low mash temp, because your enzymes during your mash had a chance to cleave off a lot of maltose molecules. That's a good chunk of the gravity that you have in there. And it's the thing that your yeast are most used to eating when they start chewing on your beer.
So also making sure that you have good levels of oxygenation in there. That's going to really kind of get them off to a absolutely running start. Ideally, I guess, also making sure that you do a starter would really help. That's going to actually bypass that whole O2 step, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so basically you'll make sure that you have your yeast ready to go. And the big starter is going to make sure that the yeast that are in there are able to eat through the O2 that's in your beer quicker. They'll get to fermenting your beer faster, and there will be more cells tackling all the sugars in there. So a good ripping starter and some good O2 will definitely make sure that your yeast viability is super strong and your beer gets fermented super fast.
Damn. Also, adding a little bit of nutrient if your beer is a little bit higher gravity. That's going to make sure that they don't stall out at any point, especially when during warm fermentations. That's the thing, just because their metabolisms are going so fast, it is easy for those yeast to sort of be in this exponential growth phase, but then stall out just because they can't take up nutrients fast enough. So adding a little extra nutrient if you got some on hand definitely doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah, and you can even add some energizer during fermentation if you want to make sure that rips through pretty fast. And one more thing that you can add at the same time during fermentation if you're going to add nutrient at that stage is also adding some enzyme. It's going to do kind of the same thing as a low mash temperature. It's just going to make sure that you have really accessible sugars in your beer so that the yeast don't have to try to chew on those longer chain sugars that are more of a struggle for those yeasts to really tackle.
Yeah, so, and what Peter's meaning by enzyme is it's usually the glucoamylase enzyme. It's actually going to be the same enzyme that you are putting to do a brut IPA. But if I were to do this, I probably wouldn't throw it in the fermentation itself so much as in my mash. I would do it the last 10 minutes of my mash just to try to get all those complex sugars to convert down into a little bit simpler ones. Peter's adjusting his mic right now. Also, though, you can get... I believe the glucoamylase is the beta enzyme. You can get alpha amylase as well. And Peter, did you end up ordering the what was the other one that was really interesting?
Ultrafirm.
The
beta glucanase.
Yeah, I think that was the beta glucanase too. So
yeah, I ordered some beta glucanase just to make sure that my mash during the mash. Well, that was because of the speed brews. I really wished I had those things in my speed brews.
Yeah. So beta glucanase will really help. What is it? Decrease the viscosity of your mash. Yeah, big words right there. And ultimately, it means that you don't have as much of a stuck mash, and it should help your beer clear up a little bit faster and also increase your fermentability and decrease the overall thickness of the beer. So
I love this comment. Peter, list in order of Peter's hatred. Carapils, Chico yeast, and Untapped.
That's not entirely wrong. All right.
No, you got to list it in order.
Oh, I mean, that was that was pretty close to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I think that was it.
I might switch Chico and Untapped.
All right. Anyway, and then, okay, yeah. So lastly, adding some simple sugars as adjunct sugars will also increase that speed up the fermentation time.
You just don't want too much of your sugars to be adjuncts because your yeast will go back and forth between eating the super simple sugars that they're good at eating and then trying to eat the longer chain sugars, yeah. And it could create a bit of a lag. So if less than, let's say, 20% of your sugar content comes from a simple sugar source, you should be fine.
Yeah, I usually try to shoot for 10%.
Hey, Tex Aviator, thank you so much for the super chat. Appreciate
that. Thank you. Yeah, I usually try to shoot for 10% if I'm doing adjunct sugars. I've never had issues keeping my total sugars or grain bill, I guess, as long as my adjunct sugars are below 10%.
Yeah.
Seems to work out just fine for me. So.
And we did get one really good question on this. For getting a grain to glass in under 6 days, do I need to let it sit warm before kegging or keg right away? What I would say, as soon as you start to see some stratification or that beer clearing, it's good to go in a keg. Yeah. It's not going to hurt anything if it's starting to clear. If it's not clarified yet and the yeast is still powdering in suspension, there might be a couple points you're still waiting to get. So go ahead and keg it, but then give it a day and then throw it in the cold and then shake and bake it.
Yeah, oftentimes the kegging can actually work really well as sort of a secondary because you're racking into your keg after, 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
It just kind of helps keep everything in suspension.
We use those as bright tanks all the time.
Yep. Also, though, use your palate, though. You know, that's the thing. So this isn't going to work for every single beer you do, but if you are really trying to push it, use your palate. You know, when you see that fermentation has stopped, you no longer see your bubbles coming out, then give it a sample. You know, if it tastes green, if it tastes like it's still kind of got like a weird orange peely character, you're getting some like peppery yeast bite or something like that, or it's just sweet if you got VDKs in there. Wow, that's a lot of words. Then you might actually have to let it sit for a couple more days before you get it cold crash. But if it's already tasting fairly clean, other than maybe a little extra yeastiness just from the yeast being in suspension, then I think you're pretty much ready at that point.
If you used Quike, you're probably good to go.
Yep.
We'll say that.
So, and that's the beauty actually about higher fermentation temperatures in general, really anything above 70 degrees is that your diacetyl rest, your VDK rest, is going to happen like that.
Yeah.
Like it's basically your VDK rest is like 12 hours at that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, those high temperatures really, really help speed up, that sort of reabsorption process of all those weird things from that your yeast throw off during fermentation.
And I'm loving the chat right now. And another thing about that is there a lot of the yeast that just ferment warm, those yeasts just don't produce VDKs in the first place, or at least they produce them in a small enough quantity that they'll never pass the flavor threshold.
So, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I think that sums up our topics. Shall we open it up for a general discussion now?
Yeah, I know we got a lot of people that are that have asked questions, so we'll scroll up a little bit. And a couple people in the chat that have been batting for us to get a bunch of likes or thumbs up on this video. Thank you to you.
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Everybody should do that right now.
Yeah, we've got 143 people watching.
If they do, I will put
my
cool cup up on our website. Or try to, anyway. This is kind of a prototype right now, but I think we might make it happen.
We'll see what we can do. But yeah, give a thumbs up on the video real quick, and we'll thumbs up. And thank you, A Touch of ADD, for the super chat. We really appreciate
that.
Wow, that's awesome.
Thank you. That was very generous.
Yeah.
He's pointing at the whole lot. All right, so what was the first question that we saw up here?
There's a lot of them up top. But people got into questions right off the bat. So let's just scroll up. Dun, 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 dun.
What was the one I saw a while back?
Some people are saying Schwarr is similar to a black lager. That's
somebody saying hot fermentations are not an issue in Scotland. hey, but it's very green there, I'm sure.
Hayden says he doesn't get much color changes on his decoction mashes.
You're not doing it long enough, Hayden. You need to do it for at least
years.
16 hours, yeah. Also, you're not drunk enough while you're doing it.
That's Hayden. I don't know.
Crystal Weizen. Somebody's asking if it's hard to find Kvike yeast. And what is it? Is it Lallemand? Actually were just able to get a hold of some Kvike, which is a dry strain. From Lallemand, so that should be available.
We've been using that a decent amount. That's actually what I pitched in our speed brew
the
other day.
Yep, so we've done it in a couple batches now, and I can't really vouch so much for the flavor profile quite yet, but I can vouch for the viability and the fermentation is just as vigorous as any other strain that we've used. So.
The sour that's in our 5-4 barrel right now is actually made with that same, the dry Lallemand, which is the Voss Kvike, and it's tasting really, really good. So, yes, and then another dry strain that just came out with Kvike is Mangrove Jacks. They came out with a Kvike strain as well. So there should be, if it's hard for you to find right now, it should be getting better in the near future. Every yeast company that I know of makes some variation with the exception of Fermentis. Someone says, yeast stalled on high gravity IPA, stalled at 1.035, using dry yeast, any ideas? My first go-to whenever I get a yeast stall is going to be add Nutrient Vitend, which is yeast energizer, and a little bit of enzyme. At the same time, I'll also try to agitate my yeast. Agitating your yeast is the number one solution that you should be doing regardless, but that enzyme and yeast energizer, those two things will really help push that up.
And I'm just going to answer it right now, too. Yes, we do use ascorbic acid.
That was like the very top. Somebody,
I saw that.
Obligatory ascorbic acid question.
We just need to do a video on that, I guess. Be like, why we put ascorbic acid in all of our beers.
Yep.
actually, somebody did that. To preserve the flavor, how much per gallon? Oh, that's actually okay. That's a legit question. KO, so per gallon ascorbic acid, we shoot for, it's really a tiny amount, half gram.
No, it's a half to a gram per gallon. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah, 0.5 gram to 1 gram per gallon. So just stupid, stupid low amounts. Only takes a touch to have the effect that you're looking for. Installed yeast.
Temp limit apply to London Ale yeast for hazies. London Ale, if you mean 10. Okay, so someone asked, does that temp limit apply to London Ale yeast for hazies? London Ale, I don't like to see over 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which I have no idea what that is in Celsius. It does still get a little bit like off fruity, and it's not a fruity that complements the hops.
That said,
even at that 70 degree range, London Ale, it's a pretty banging yeast. It does a really good job. If by London Ale, you mean Y yeast 1028.
Yeah. We got Alexander is asking about whether a high temperature with a high pressure will work And I'm thinking that your theory is that if you pressure ferment, you'll keep that beer a little cleaner. And it might be a little bit, but probably not, depending on how hot the temperature is. You're definitely not going to have a beer that is fermented at, say, 65 degrees, you know, super, super clean ale yeast, versus fermenting that same beer at, say, 80 degrees under 10 PSI. While it's going to be, it will slow down the yeast growth, so it should technically be cleaner. It doesn't quite have as big of an effect as you're probably going to expect from it. So while I don't think it'll hurt anything, you're probably not going to end up with a super, super clean beer as a result.
We got one question that says, what are the pros versus cons of raw brews? And that all depends on your techniques and what you do to make sure that your raw brews work the way you want them to. For a lot of sours, raw brews work really well, in my opinion, just going lactobacillus one day and then adding your co-pitch in the next day or 2 days later. Most of those beers are pretty plug and play. They're super, super easy to do, which is one of the pros. Raw beers are really short and easy to make. One of the cons is that if you want to do a clean raw beer, like a raw lager or a raw IPA, you're going to have to get fancy with adding things like enzyme during fermentation and maybe even during the mash. And then any sort of hopping you want to get is going to have to be either dry hopping, or if you want that bitterness, then you're going to have to find another way to boil the hops outside of it. So it does take some more technique, which is a con. But other than that, I mean, unless you have a malt that has DMSO, basically if it's sat in a humid environment for a while and has a precursor to DMS, there's really not a lot of risk in today's malt in terms of doing raw beers.
Like I have noticed every raw beer we do has an assertive graininess to it, though.
They can be grainy.
That you don't get when you boil it.
But you can zyme those out, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's where you'd have to do something, some kind of an extra step if you don't want that extra graininess in the final product. But who makes London? What's London Fog?
London Fog?
Australia. Peter Cato, why are you up at 2:30 in the morning? Wait, you must have a 6-month-old too. You see what I did there?
I don't. What, you made a connection? someone says extract versus all grain. We've kind of done raw extract beers, but a lot of those are basically they're completely done with the mash anyway. In that case, you're just going to get with basically a lot more like haze or protein-forming haze if you have an extract non-boiled beer.
Yeah.
For those of you kind of trying to catch up, when we're saying raw, we mean a beer that has never been boiled.
Yeah. I've done a 0-minute boil extract beers, and they've actually turned out really clear for me. I've had a couple just like drop stupidly bright. That was actually one that I fermented warm with 3470 was a 0-minute. I brought the beer up to a hot break, threw hops in it, threw it in a fermenter, pitched yeast, checked on it.
That one's not technically raw, but...
checked on it 2 days later, and I was bummed because I didn't see any fermentation activity, and then when I actually looked in the beer, it had actually finished out and dropped completely bright already. And I was like, oh, that's because it's just beer now.
Speaking of 3470, somebody asks, what is the coldest we have fermented 3470? We've gone down to like 52 degrees. I don't think we've done like
I've gone a little colder at my house just because, you know, it was the middle of winter. I think I've gotten down into like 47, 48, and I mean, it'll do its thing regardless. You're just going to start really, really slow in the yeast fermentation down at that point. So, you know, don't expect a 6-day turnover at 47 degrees. That's for sure. That's going to take probably a good couple months to actually finish out. So, which isn't bad if you got the time. Honestly, it ends up with a really nice, clean beer. So, is there a category for clean black lager? Yeah, Schwarz beer. That's
pretty much it. Schwarz beers are really nice. So they have that same kind of graininess that you can get from like a true German lager. But other than that, they're super, super clean.
Yeah, what is the category for that? I don't remember. Schwarz beers are actually one of my favorites. And like we mentioned, compared to the international dark lager, Schwarz beers are going to be more robust and have a slightly chewier mouthfeel. Well, actually, I shouldn't say slightly. They should be significantly chewier, not having that super bone dry finish that you're going to expect from an international dark lager.
Someone's asking, they did a partial mash last weekend and had a tough time getting the temperature in the pan consistent. It was 5 to 10 degrees differential. Should you worry too much? Yes and no. Since it's a partial mash, there's really not a ton to worry about because you're still going to get a lot of that flavor off the grain. The soluble stuff that's in grain that gives you flavor will all be in your final beer.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about contemporary malts is a lot of them are highly modified, meaning some of the sugar quality is just going to be there and ready to go anyways. That said, you might lose some potential sugars and you might end up with some extra like dextrins and higher proteins and stuff in your beer. So it's not going to be the same beer, but it's not going to be a bad beer.
I think short answer on that one is that no, that's not ideal, but I mean, you're doing a partial mash and probably like a 1 gallon pot on your stovetop. So if you can, if you only have a 5 degree temperature swing, I think you're doing pretty good there.
Well, it's Celsius, but.
Oh, Celsius. Oh yeah. That's a little hot, but.
Do we still ride the tandem scooter to the brewery? Not every day, but yesterday we did ride from the brewery to a bar.
Tandem does work.
Yeah, it's a sweet scooter.
You also get funny looks from people.
Yeah, I pretty much am sure that we just made a lot of friends along the way.
Especially when you're singing Low Rider the whole time.
Yeah. All my friends love a Low Rider.
All righty.
The best BrewDog beer in your opinion. So I don't know a lot about the BrewDog recipes. I did read through them, and a lot of the IPA recipes seem pretty quality, although it's in it's not an Imperial, so I don't read it as easily as I do American numbers. That said, BrewDog beers that make it over here are all terrible.
Yep.
Because it's not because BrewDog made them bad, but it's because they're made.
Because it
export.
Takes like 3 months to get here.
And so when people got really hyped about BrewDogs, and then we found BrewDogs in Spokane, I was very skeptical, and then I tried them, and every single one that
and
I tried
like,
was just
like, this was made last year.
Yeah, it's not good. If you're trying to make craft beer, then don't try to ship it across the world and still call it the same beer. Doesn't work that way.
Go to yeast, by the way, for a lager yeast and warm temps is definitely going to be that Vine Stefan 3470.
Oh yeah.
It's just, we've had such consistency with it. I mean, it's hard to beat. We will eventually distribute in Southern California in like a long time. Sorry.
Nick Graham asks, how do you adjust the dry hop schedule for a NEPA when using Quaic? Is there any point to biotransformation sip or just throw it all in at the end? So we actually do biotransformation dry hop, our locale IPA. Which starts at 1.030 original gravity, and the very next day is at 1.010, and that's when we add our dry hops, our enzyme, and our nutrient at the same time. Yeah. And then usually by the next day, it's completely done fermenting.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I saw somebody said that they actually dry hopped after 7 hours on a Quaic, and here's why I feel like that's not probably the best technique. And that's because you're going to get such a ripping fermentation from it. You're actually, at 7 hours, your fermentation is just kicking off. So over the next 24 to 48 hours, you're actually going to drive off a lot of those aromatics that you actually want in the beer. So I feel like while it's not going to hurt the beer, it's probably not the best use of hops because you're actually kind of getting rid of some of those nice aromatics that you're trying to stay in the beer, which is why we usually hop at, you know, day two, day three, when that fermentation is, I don't know, what would you say, like, you know, 60%, 70% complete, somewhere in there.
Basically just working on the larger sugars that aren't as active.
Yeah, just because the thing's literally boiling in there from the fermentation. So you got so much CO2 driving off those aromatics. I just feel like that's probably not the best use of hops.
Hayden recommended we make a visceral diketone shirt.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it. I was like, dang it, did I say that again?
I don't think you said it today, but I'm glad that a lot of people picked up on that.
Not saying it anymore. I'm just saying the acidal rest now.
Or VDK. Just say VDK.
You're a VDK.
Like you were saying, dry hopping a NEPA with Quaic too early, you can lose some of the aromatics. Still won't be bad, but you might, because some of the biotransformation stuff still stays in there, but some of the other nice balancing volatiles will pop out.
Kaboom. I mean, it'll smell amazing when it's fermenting, so if you just want your house to smell like an IPA for a couple days, then, you know, go for it. Hazy Jane from BrewDog. We should probably just take a trip over to BrewDog.
Probably.
That's a business expense, right?
Yeah. Or we'll just reach out to them and say, hey BrewDog, I know you're a little bit smaller than our scale that we do here, but we'd still humble you with our visit if you paid for it.
Aubrey S23, I think would be actually a really good candidate to pressure ferment if you did want to go that route. Like I said, though, here we don't so much as pressure ferment as we do spund, and that's really just to kind of save on gas more than anything else. So, most of our beers we might ferment under a little bit of pressure, but it's on the big scheme of things, it's probably not.
It's mostly just to save CO2 for us.
Yep.
Someone says, thoughts of letting British ale yeast ferment at 65 degrees and then letting it rise to 72 degrees towards the end. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty appropriate fermentation schedule to me. But just make sure that your yeast is still relatively active when you go up to that 72. If it's starting to clarify, at this point, like on the commercial scale, what we do is at the same time as we're increasing the temperature, we'll throw some CO2 at it too, just to make sure we're kicking that yeast up in suspension. So we're agitating the yeast at that point.
Yeah. I mean, or let it rise up to 90, and you know, have a barley wine tear down to,
that wasn't British ale.
Almost single digits.
That wasn't British ale. Hey, that beer's still tasting good. So you know what?
It's because you added enzyme to that too, didn't you?
Yeah, I enzymed it. So what the 90-plus degree temperature spike did when our glycol chiller went out is actually made sure that there was a lot of simple sugars to eat.
That was a sad day right there.
Hey, but it's in the bright tank. It's ready to keg, and it's tasting pretty dang good. So,
bam. Final gravity to keg and spund a Belle Saison at. Usually it's actually surprisingly low, but it's also really hard to hit that gravity. I would probably keg it when you've got 5 or 6 points to go gravity-wise, but that'll happen pretty darn fast, too.
Well, it depends on your OG. If your OG is 1070 and you've got a lot of, like, flaked wheat in there, then, you know, you get down to, like, 1.020 and you might only have 5 or 6 points. But if your final gravity is, or if your OG is 1.045 and you get down to 1020, then you probably still got another, like, 12 points to drop. So
yeah,
it kind of depends. And so if you know what you expect your final gravity to be, then yeah, somewhere in the 5 to 8 original gravity points is kind of the 1 to 2 bricks basically.
Really don't need much to carbonate is the bottom line.
It also depends on your headspace. Yeah. So there's some things that go into calculating it. How much headspace you have will basically mean, you know, how much of that CO2 is going to go into the beer versus going to go into, but if you're kegging, that should be obviously pretty well topped off.
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt to, you know, have a little bit of CO2 get purged out too. That's the beauty of kind of racking into a vessel before the beer is completely fermented, is just because you get that CO2 layer that sort of kind of pushes everything out of the vessel.
What's a good yeast for a steam style beer? Cal Lager, the Anchor beer.
I mean, that's not a good yeast. That is the yeast.
That's the yeast.
That's what steam beer is.
Yeah, Cal Lager is a 2112 in Y East. Mangrove Jacks makes a Cal Lager. It is Cable Car and Imperial.
Oh, I was gonna say. I was like, wait a second. What is an Imperial?
Yeah, but yeah, that's the one to use. And it's you can honestly probably get away with something like 3470, the fine Stefan strain, and ferments it warm. But basically, it's one of those hybrid yeasts. That's a lager yeast that can ferment warm and has a really pleasant fruitiness while you do so.
Yeah. Adding lemon to a Hefeweizen. What time do you add that? Or lemon flavor. If it's flavor, you could probably add that at any point. I'd just
pack
it
in.
Yeah, add it whenever you're kegging it up or bottling.
But if you're trying to add like zest or something like that, I add it like a day before I keg or bottle.
Yeah, zest in my experience is best added like you're adding a dry hop to a beer.
Yeah.
A couple, 3 days before you plan on doing whatever. Try not to let it sit too long on the zest. I don't think you're going to get any off flavors from the zest, but mostly for me, it's a issue of how sanitary was that zest going into the beer.
Yeah.
So you don't want to let it, you know, sit in there for a month and then get some kind of contamination.
If it's
issue.
Good and washed and you express the oils on the lemon before you add it, it should be fine because it's obviously highly acidic and those oils are actually antimicrobial as well.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I do. I do whole peel and then I squeeze the peel just a little bit to express the oils and then throw that in. That seems to work for me. Yeah. But just a couple of days before.
The flavor is more or less instant, I think, when you're doing that.
Yeah, it's just getting the oils. It's just, the flavor mostly comes from the oils anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asks, ever use fenugreek to add maple flavor to beer? No, I have not.
What is fenugreek?
I do not know. So we will have to look that up and try it. That sounds interesting.
Noted.
Noted.
How do you spell fenugreek?
F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K.
Done. Noted. What else we got here? Thoughts on Philly Sour?
We haven't used that yet.
No, we have not. Yeah. What is the crazy name? That looks like one of our beer names right there. Lachania yeast.
Brewed off flavors on purpose, like buttery flavors with corn, etc. We haven't brewed off flavors on purpose, no, but we have definitely, like, when it's happened. A good example is when we did a saison in a Burgundy barrel the very first time, before we let it Brett out. That bourbon barrel had malolactic bacteria in there, which malolactic bacteria, the purpose of that in wine is actually to add some buttery flavor and balance out pH in wine. And so we got a very, very buttery beer right off the bat. We ended up breading that out, but we used that. We kicked one off and used that to kind of teach people what that buttery flavor is.
Yeah, that was actually ended up turning out to be a really good beer too. What else we got here? Weed instead of hops.
We did a whole live stream on that.
Yeah.
Go watch it.
Yep. We did answer that. But yeah, you're not really going to get bitterness from it. It's a tricky thing.
Dry hopping under pressure, any worries of diacetyl? Depends on your yeast strain and your temperature.
Yep. You can definitely get diacetyl creep, especially if you're doing that under pressure, because you're going to kind of slow down that yeast fermentation. How's your quarantine? We are not in quarantine technically anymore. So we're on
it's phase. Going it's
we're,
going
we're
better.
Like partial quarantine, I guess, here.
Yeah. One of my businesses is struggling right now. So that worries me. That's not good because it's still on shutdown mode.
Yeah, it's not going to open for a while unless they change things. Oh yeah.
Hey, I think we're caught up.
Fossil guy Tom. Tried to get.
Yeah, we'll probably take a couple more questions before closing this out. It is almost time for us to get opened up here. If you're watching right now and you haven't yet given a like/thumbs up on this video, please do so. We appreciate that. It helps these videos get some traction after the live stream ends. But we'll take a couple more questions. And thank you so much for anybody who's been tuning in and watching. Thank you super, super much for those of you that super chatted. We appreciate that. It helps us kind of justify waking up early and doing these every Sunday.
You're super beer awesome. Nailed it.
Beer great.
All righty. Yeah, thank you, everyone. So I guess just to kind of sum up the last somebody, Adam, did make a note about sanitation with zest, and I think this can actually be applied to a wide range of things that you plan on throwing in your beer, and that is just soaking them in some hard A. Adding zest to hard A, you're going to actually infuse the alcohol, you know, whatever neutral spirit you have sitting around. I've done this with vanilla beans as well. Yep. Oak kind of made all kinds of different tinctures, which is what you're doing at that point. And they actually do work really well. They generally have a slightly different impact on the flavor compared to adding it directly in, but it's a very instantaneous impact as well. So gets the job done, especially if you are in a pinch.
Yeah, Star Sand also works. Star Sand won't hurt your beer because yeast eat it. So best way to drop pH for
Star
a
Sand.
Kettle sour. So someone's asking best way to...
Star Sand.
Oh, drop your pH with Star Sand?
Yeah.
Straight
yeah,
phosphoric acid.
Just straight Star Sand. Lactic acid.
Lactic acid is the best way to drop your pH in a kettle sour. You want to pre-acidify your kettle sour before letting your bacteria do its work. You want to pre-acidify to at least 4.5. In the commercial world, 4.2 is a technical food safe mark, but 4.5 will do just fine. You can use lactic acid or you can use some acid malts. Now, I'm just using calculators online to find out how much you're going to need to add depending on the pH of your beer or mash. And don't drop your pH too much before you actually mash, because most of your enzymes won't work very well at that low of a pH. And so if you end up, you know, with a 4.2 pH mash, you're going to end up with a lot of starches and not a lot of sugars in your beer. So
yep, you get a poor conversion as a result.
Do your full mash, then add your acid and then sparge off into whatever you're fermenting in, and then add your lactobacillus, and then you're good to go.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. We will see you next week at 8:45 Pacific Standard Time.
Logan's going to answer our "Do we have recipes in place?" question.
Do we have recipes? Are all your recipes in one place? For those of you that are wondering about all the random recipes we throw together, we do put them on Brewer's Friend. I believe you can actually look us up on there, Genus Brewing. You should see a whole list of recipes. We tried to honestly put every recipe we build as public. So if you want to kind of go through and see all the random recipes that we've put together for, you know, either YouTube or even our customers, they should all be public on Brewer's Friend. So
don't think that they're all going to be great, though, because some of them
That is true. Yes. Not all of them are great, so read through them with a grain of salt. All righty. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.